You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 12th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House. We're coming to you live from Studio One. This is Emma Nelson. On today's show, Kurdish forces claim to have made ground against IS militants in the Iraqi town of Sinjar. My studio guests, Nina Schick and Robert Fox, will assess the Kurds' progress and find out where it fits in the wider offensive. Also ahead, the British Prime Minister announces he has big ambitions for Anglo-Indian relations as the red carpet is rolled out for the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi.
Prime Minister Cameron and I are indeed very pleased that cooperation and affordable and accessible clean energy is an important pillar of our relations.
Mr. Modi there with just one of his items on his £9 billion shopping list during his three-day visit to London. And after lecturing its neighbours on their attitudes towards migrants, Sweden imposes border controls. And we love you, but there are limits. The Swedish Prime Minister warns the UK not to ask too much from the EU. That's all to be discussed on Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today in the studio, Nina Schick, Director of Communications at Open Europe, and also Robert Fox, the Defence Editor of the London Evening Standard. Welcome both to the programme. Now, Kurdish forces claim to have launched a major offensive and to have made great progress against IS militants near to Sinjar in northern Iraq. The fighters say they've taken a major supply route, supported by airstrikes from the US-led coalition. But it's more than a year since IS took control of Sinjar, so why has it taken them this long? Welcome to the both to the programme. Bring us up to date, please, Robert, if you would, in your role as Defence Editor of the Evening Standard. What has happened near to Sinjar?
They are beginning to get weapons that are being dropped to, in inverted commas, friendly forces. They've been aiming for the Free Syrian Army. And by that, I mean the Americans principally, nobody else. There's been a bit of help with Brits and the French, but they really don't count in this game. It was always logical to give the staff to Kurdish forces, Peshmerga principally, but the really effective ones have been, it's very difficult, the division between the Kurds is the Kurds, the militias associated with the OPKK, Kurdish Workers' Party, that did a terrific job in land air coordination and really shook up ISIS at Kobani. What is interesting about this is, yes, it is strategic because, as you said in your introduction, it is on a main supply route. This is a big smuggling area. And if they disrupt the smuggling operations of oil, principally, by truck, which goes through this area, it is a big blow. But I think there's another fascinating, almost spiritual side to this. Sinjar is the holy mountain of the holy area of the Yazidis. The fact that people want to go back to a place and are not just pouring out of it is really psychologically extremely interesting and important. But it may be too early to count. We've heard all these things before. And it is, remember, a battle of propaganda above all.
Nina, listening to that, Robert raises the point of the spiritual side of Sinjar itself. But also, it's key, isn't it, that the forces on the ground have to be seen to be local and have to be seen to be taking the initiative themselves. This has to be run by local forces, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And this is, you know, the Western proxy war against IS being fought by the Peshmerga fighters. And it is the biggest offensive to date, And I think Robert is correct in pointing out how quickly can it be wrapped up. We've seen headlines saying, you know, they've made significant advances. But let's not forget this route has lots of booby traps along the way. So whether or not this battle, quote unquote, has been won remains to be seen. I do find that symbolic importance very, very interesting, because let's not forget, this is where not too long ago the Yazidi population faced horrific events at the hands of IS, including the execution of all the men and the women then being subsequently enslaved and taken as sex prisoners by IS, and they're still being sold in the markets in Mosul and Raqqa. So I think it's tremendously important, the symbolic value of this location as well as the strategic one, which we've just discussed.
Of course, it was the Yazidis, thousands of them were killed when Sinjar was taken last year, and then the atrocities that Nina speaks of occurred. The Yazidi militia, however, have been given an awful lot of help by the likes of the PKK, training them up to actually take on the likes of Islamic State. It all suddenly becomes terribly complicated, doesn't it? Well, it always has been complicated.
It is an ugly fact, not universally conceded, to paraphrase Jane Austen, that the PKK are darn good fighters, and they have a hell of a history. And this is a thing that I think that NATO has been in denial about. There is no doubt about it. The British have been absolutely the worst in picking proxies and in supplying proxies. And in fact, just a few weeks ago, or a matter of days ago, we had the death of Ahmad Chalabi, who was the very worst and most duplicitous kind of proxy that got a lot of people persuaded to go into a war in Iraq in 2003. So what we're beginning to see is something rather different. It's people who do know their mind and do know what they want and do see there's not much interest in escaping and trying to go to a notional Shangri-La in Europe or the Caucasus where they might otherwise go. I think there is a very interesting point about ISIS-ISIL here. I think that they may have reached their point of culmination, as you say in military terms, both physically and in propaganda terms. Remember, just a few years ago, it was all al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia and Zarqawi, who was the big menace. And then that seemed to fade out. And it does look like a rolling ocean. There's different things moving. There are different fashions moving. But the other big news today is this amazing roundup of jihadi suspects among the Kurdish diaspora in Europe, picked up initially by the Italians, who've led this operation, and they've rounded up 16 of them. And if what they say is true, and it is ministers of justice, it's lawyers, it's not just policemen leading this thing. They said that this group aimed to take out the Kurdish leadership in the autonomy. That would be the Talabani clan, that would be the Barzanis, and to kill British and Norwegian diplomats. There is a very good reason why you would want to kill them, because, of course, they have been making inroads against this group. But, to quote you again, Emma, boy, is it complex. And when is a mosaic rattled around? What does it become? It's a kaleidoscope, and it's rocking along. Because, I'll just add another thing, the Russians now don't seem to be doing as well as they said that they were against ISIL and
I did wish to ask you about this, because it's always a great pleasure talking to you about Russian involvement in all this. The Russians...
Was that some irony? I hope it was.
The Russians were dominating the proceedings about 3-4 weeks ago. They'd absolutely spooked everybody. And then two things have happened. First and foremost, the Russian airliner has gone down. And that changes the game completely.
Lightning war, yeah.
But also you get this this thing now where the Kurdish fighters who have been trained by the United States, that there were no troops directly involved in this assault, but the US has said, yes, we were involved from behind the scenes in this. This suddenly becomes a moment where the United States can perhaps seize the initiative politically and militarily and say, this is the war that we should have been fighting. We're not getting involved, but we are really helping the others to win.
Well, your premise, which you started out with, is absolutely right. It has to be local forces. This is where, you know, mixing and matching really does not work. And I think you and I were on together about 2 or 3 days ago, and I said, actually, how limited the Russian effort can be. Russia is pretty stretched. It had to retool its whole military machine after the near defeat in Ossetia, Georgia in 2008. And there aren't all that many, Emma. There are about 3,000 all told military personnel, plus about 26, 28 aircraft. They can only do so much. And curiously, we're not seeing huge signs of reinforcement, because I don't think they've got the wherewithal to do it. Ukraine is still there, not satisfactory at all from Moscow's perspective. And as you rightly say, with the downing of the airliner, they've got a genuine asymmetric terror war spreading now and involving them directly.
Nina, your area of expertise generally is Europe. Robert said that the French and the British weren't really, I can't remember what the exact term was, but weren't exactly pulling their weight in terms of offensive. What should Europe's role be in all this?
It's very difficult. I mean, when you talk about Europe, you're talking about a body which is made out of 28 different member states. So trying to even decide a policy when you have 28 different heads of state trying to get their own interests on the map is extremely difficult. There is no such thing as a European army. There is no common European defense policy. So this is why it's left mostly to Britain and France, who are seen as the foreign defense leaders in the EU, to fall back in situations like this. They probably haven't done enough. And I think there is an opportunity for the UK, at least, to make some strategic gain here by showing leadership in this field. It would convince its EU partners, of course, in the context of the current renegotiation of the UK's EU membership, that it is a valid partner. It has, if it is able to flex its diplomacy and foreign affairs muscle.
Robert, we mentioned how complicated it was a moment ago, and the fact was that Sinjar was seized last year, but there have been reports that this offensive to take back either Sinjar or at least the road between Raqqa and Mosul has been delayed because of all the complications and the rivals, the rivalry between the Peshmerga, the PKK, the Syrian affiliates of the PKK, all of whom will want to have control of this area of ground in the event that there is an IS defeat.
If they're realistic, and underneath all the rhetoric, they are very realistic, they'll want to have a piece of it. It's always been a piece of pieces. I can remember being in Kurdistan a lot, and you'd always come up with a great Kurdish maxim, adage, oh, the Kurds' only friend is the mountains. But I was talking to groups of refugees, this is 91, and they came over the valley, and I said, well, look at those people over there, can you speak to them? They said, we can barely speak their dialect. They are so divided. But what has happened? The uncalculated, unintended consequence of 91 was that you had got a Kurdish autonomy in the north. And it's funny that you should say that, you know, the British are so diffident. I think there's tremendous... Let's put my cards on the table. I find in the ethos of Cameroniana, particularly Cameron's group in Downing Street, including Oliver Letwin, such reluctance to get involved, to engage with this. Whereas culturally, in places like Erbil, the British have been very, very involved, setting up the university, running it very successfully, providing the vice-chancellor and so on with very, very good relations. And you would have thought that they would be capitalising on this. But you don't hear of it at all. It is still disengagement, because when Cameron... tried his little bits of Tony Blair adventurism, namely Libya. He got a bloody nose. It all went wrong. And so there really is such a will now not to get involved, which will be emphasised when we get the defence reviews and the national security strategy of Britain announced and put on paper at the end of this month. But it's driving the alliance, or the allies of Britain, Australia, France, as well as America, completely to distraction at the moment.
Okay, you were talking about Cameroniana and the unwillingness of them to get involved in certain areas. Well, we should move to one subject where they are keen as mustard. We move now to the United Kingdom. It's less than 3 weeks, by my reckoning, I could be wrong, since the red carpet was rolled out for the Chinese President Xi Jinping. Well, it's been hoovered and it's back out again for a state visit by the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi. Now, as with China's leader, the British Prime Minister has heaped praise on relations between the two countries and has also trumpeted the business potential between Britain and India. But not before Mr. Modi's arrival, warnings for Mr. Cameron not to get too cosy with another leader with a dubious track record in human rights. Nina, Narendra Modi, a huge Indian population in the United Kingdom. He's going to deliver an enormous address at Wembley Stadium in the next few days. By all accounts, it will dwarf Madison Square Gardens. How welcome is this man in the UK?
Well, I think that he is quite welcome, also because of the diaspora here, the Indian diaspora. And as you mentioned, that speech at Wembley will be targeted mostly at the Indian diaspora in the UK and also to the audience waiting back home. Now, I think this is very much an opportunity for Cameron and Modi to develop a more of a personal relationship. Let's remember that this is the first visit by an Indian PM in over 10 years. It's also the first time ever that an Indian PM has the honour, quote unquote, to speak in Parliament like he did today. He's having lunch with the Queen tomorrow. And from Modi's perspective, it will be showing his own people how powerful he is. But from the UK perspective, they will try to push India towards economic reforms and human rights reforms. Of course, one thing, I'm half Nepalese, so one thing why Modi's made the headline in South Asia recently, which hasn't really been picked up that much in the international press, is the economic blockade that they've put on the neighbouring small country of Nepal. Why? Because they didn't like the constitution that the Nepalese government had wrangled together after 8 years, and they basically blocked all the supply lines to Nepal. It's still going on, over a month. And so he's, in some South Asian circles, he's seen as a tyrant. So he's not only known for that in India, but also in South Asia.
Dina mentions the Nepalese issue. We have the issue which has got so many feathers ruffled in the UK ahead of his arrival, which was the 2002 riots in which I think it's 1,000 Muslims were killed. Modi has always denied his involvement in it, but it's what nearly got him banned from going to the US. To what degree, as was the case with the Chinese, are the British government keeping their eyes open, holding their nose and swallowing?
I think absolutely so, because there's been tremendous protest from a very significant part of the Asian population, as Nina was saying, from the Sikhs, who feel that they have been abused and worse, and not only human rights, but atrocities, abuse have been carried out. And of course, the critics of this brand of Hindu nationalism that Modi is seen as the progenitor of this thing about accusing people of eating cow meat, of eating beef and so on. I was reading through the literature. There are well-known names who actually name him, say, we believe he is behind this kind of hate propaganda. And we've had Salman Rushdie and we've had Ian McEwan, very serious and very well thought out protest. And it's not even water off a duck's back for Cameron, because I think there is a line, just to draw it together, between him and the Chinese leader. It's give us the money. Because what I fear, and I think that this is what is running also behind the European argument, is things are looking very bad about a year out from now for the British economy. And it's simply because of this. One of the fundamentals has been going so badly wrong that nobody's really noticed it, and that's the balance of payments. Balance of payments has always been concealed by inward investment. The inward investment is no longer inward. And this is from a very good friend of mine, Bill Keegan, who is one of the economic gurus, you know, now aged commentator and respected in the Observer, works in the Bank of England, knows the Bank of England, the Treasury inside out. He said what they've noticed over the last 18 months is this inward investment is actually going outward, because it comes into corporate finance, nominally coming to the UK, it isn't. It's going elsewhere. That, coupled to the pound being far too high, leads him to believe that by Christmas 2016, we're going to have an absolutely classic sterling crisis. And I suspect somewhere in Cameroniana, somebody is beginning to identify this. That's why they're saying to Modi and to the Chinese, give us the money, give us the money, you know, invest, invest, invest.
There is that slight difference, though, perhaps, isn't there, Nina, between the investment that the United Kingdom was promised by China, and perhaps the possibilities that the United Kingdom itself could start to invest in India. One was given the impression a few weeks ago, and I could be wrong, that the Chinese visit was very much an opportunity for Xi Jinping to start hoovering up a bit of British family silver, if necessary, you know, whatever they so desired. India already has this huge presence in the United Kingdom. I think it's what 110,000 people are employed by an Indian company, Tata, owning Jaguar Land Rover and Tetley T. You couldn't get bigger British brands. To what degree, though, can the United Kingdom then jump into India and say, OK, we're going to invest in your telecoms? power service industry and actually invest somewhere else to ultimately bring the cash back to the UK?
I think that is part of what Brand Modi is. He's trying to convince investors, British investors, that India is a safe place to invest. However, it is not as easy to invest in India as it is in China, for example. There's still a lot of protectionism. And this is what my point about how Cameron will be trying to use his influence on Modi to push forward some economic reforms. I mean, Brand Modi is saying to the UK, you know, growth in China is going to halve. We're on course to grow 8% a year. But even if growth in China halves, that's only, you know, the Chinese economy is still two times as big as the Indian economy. And from my own experience of living in India, it's change is very incremental and slow because of certain cultural barriers that still exist.
That's a very diplomatic way of saying it. It's 18:20 here in London. We're going to take a quick break. You're with Midori House here with Emma Nelson live with Nina Schick and Robert Fox. Coming up in just a moment, it's often dubbed one of the most welcoming and tolerant nations in Europe. So why has Sweden imposed border controls? Stay with us.
We should have breakfast together and lunch and coffee and cake and a forced beer or even an Aperol Spritz at sunset. And we know just the perfect spot. Come and join us at our London cafe that's just around the corner from our Midori HQ and also close to the Monocle shop. While you have a great flat white made with all-press coffee, you'll no doubt bump into one of our team and get to hear all the latest from the Monocle world. You can also pick up the latest issue of the magazine. Oh, and we also have space for hosting private lunches and events too. Join us at 18 Chiltern Street in London and also at our outpost in the Hankyu Men's Department Store in Tokyo. We look forward to seeing you.
Welcome back to Midori House. We're live here on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson joining me in the studio, Nina Schick and Robert Fox. Sweden has a reputation for being one of the most liberal and tolerant nations in Scandinavia. In fact, in all of the world. Among its neighbours, though, it has a reputation on occasion for clambering upon a high horse and telling others to be more accepting of foreigners. But the country has suddenly introduced border checks to control the flow of migrants and refugees. There have been so many arriving, there is a threat to public order. Nina, well, it's about nearly 200,000 migrants expected to arrive in Sweden this year. That's more per head of a population than any other EU nation. Apparently, if you Google refugee or asylum in Arabic, the first word that comes up is Sweden. This is what Sweden's been all about in the eyes of so many refugees for so long now.
Yes, it has been all about that. However, if you look at public opinion in Sweden, it's a small country of 9.8 million people. So if you think that 200,000 people might come in a year, for the majority of the public, it's just too much, too quickly. They feel the government has no control. And the way we can see this being exemplified is in the rise of the Sweden Democrats. This is a party that's shunned by all the mainstream parties, political parties in Sweden, because so far it's still quite taboo in the mainstream to talk critically, perhaps, about the issue of immigration. They were at 5% in 2010, and now they're at almost 30%. And
that's
this is
huge.
A neo-Nazi right-wing party, the Sweden Democrats. And I think the government has made a tactical error by not having a more honest conversation with the public about immigration, refugees, asylum seekers, and what that means. And there are huge problems of integration in Sweden. So this idea that it's this Scandinavian Shangri-La is, unfortunately, it's a myth. It's not true. On the border checks themselves, what Sweden has done is introduced temporary border controls, but it's not the first European country to have done that. Germany's done that. France has done that. Austria has done that. It's only one in many European countries continuing along this trend as Europe basically struggles to deal with a migration crisis and cannot get any kind of coherent response into place.
So, Robert, in that context, the talks in Valletta in the last few hours, the Swedish Prime Minister has said, we need another system, this is obvious. And Donald Tusk, the EU Council President, has said, this is now a race against time to save Schengen. Nina's listed all the countries who've closed their borders for whatever reason, good or bad. But Schengen is snapping.
Yes, and I think it's bound to. I think it's bound to because as significant, I mean, who am I to judge? But is the razor wire on the Slovene-Croat border, because they've actually said the same thing. They said whatever the rights are, we do respect the UN principles of human rights. That's what the Swedish government seems to be saying, and indeed the government in Ljubljana seems to be been saying. But at one crossing, the Slovene authorities were saying we cannot take 9,000 a day, which we've had from time to time. And this is where it is becoming impossible. It is very difficult to get people to talk reality about this, because I'm not surprised about this happening in Sweden, because I'm a huge addict of Scandi Noir. And the great Henning Mankell, who died only a few days ago, always flagged this up. Can we really do it? The really great writers who write literature out of this stuff, the Marxist couple, who I can never pronounce, Stoll and Inspector Beck. It's all about what kind of society can Sweden be with this level of incoming, which changes the nature. I sound like Theresa May here, but I don't mean to. The bit that I look
at, I was getting worried,
from personal experience, is I've been writing and looking at this in Italy for 45 years, and I've been working in Italy for just over 50 years. And the thing is that we hear these statistics. Yes, we had telephone directory numbers coming out of the EU summit at Valletta. There'd be 1,200,000 coming into the EU. And do you know what I wanted to say to them? How on earth do you know? Because I happen to know, on the great lengths of the Adriatic coast in Italy, and probably on the same on the other side, the other shore, as it were, in Croatia and Dalmatia, there have been hundreds on a good night coming ashore a night. Never counted, never ending up in anybody's statistics. And for the Italians, they identified this problem and was said, let's have a Marshall Plan to deal with this, in 1980. And this is where Tusk, I have to say, he's got a bit of a point. It's a bit late to say, oh, we must think about this now. The world is changing shape for many, many reasons. I've put in a book proposal about this today. Can I get a single publisher interested? No.
Well, you've just given your pitch live on air, so thanks for that. Now, the EU, Nina, has agreed to, what, 1.8 billion euros to help Africa tackle the root cause of irregular migration, solving the problem at its root, it is claiming. Oxfam's come back and said, look, you're blurring the lines between aid for helping lifting people out of poverty and actually bolstering African states' border control. What can the EU do that doesn't get it absolutely slammed and criticised for whatever it says it needs to do?
Well, I think the intra-EU response to the whole migration crisis has been woefully inadequate. We can discuss it in more detail if you like. So I think they're taking the right step in the sense that they're trying to tackle the problem at its source, and they're trying to distinguish between those who are actually refugees and those who are economic migrants, an important distinction to make. However, they can't simply, I mean, the feedback from the African leaders has been like, this is just European arrogance. You can't simply march here now and offer us money and then expect us to play ball. The prize for the EU leaders at Valletta, which I knew they wouldn't get, but which they're pushing towards, is to get the African nations to sign up to deportation agreements. So far, the EU only has one such agreement, and it's with Cape Verde. They've been trying since 2003 to sign one such agreement with Morocco, but without the sub-Saharan African countries on board, Morocco doesn't want to play ball because it doesn't want to become the latest bottleneck in the migrant crisis.
So the Prime Minister of Sweden has asked to join the EU's relocation scheme. It wants 54,000 migrants to be moved around. You shake your heads, and you've chuckled as well. We have 50 seconds, ladies and gentlemen, to explain why you've shaken your head.
Because it's like trying to make water flow uphill. This thing is absolutely defining, because there are several causes to it, but climate change, demographic change, the fact that the human race is going to almost double in just over a century, and governance is suffering. The person who really seems to have an approach, and I think it's very incomplete, is Professor Sir Paul Collier. It is a development problem, and it's a problem where governance must be developed above all.
The relocation scheme by the EU has been an utter joke. 160,000 refugees earmarked for relocation. So far, 147 of those have actually been moved.
So 1%?
Yes.
Excellent. That's a satisfying start, isn't it? That's all we have time for today's Midori House. Thank you to Nina Schick from Open Europe and Robert Fox from the Evening Standard. They're joining me here for the last half hour on Midori House. My thanks to my producer, Tom Hall, my researcher, Bill Lutie and Aidan McLaughlin, and to our studio manager, Kieran Banerjee. Next up, for the next half hour, Matt Alagaya keeps you company with Monocle's International Playlist. And then at 1900 hours, it's The Urbanist. Your host for that, our editor, Andrew Tuck. And at 2200, The Monocle Daily. I'll be joined by Peter Cardwell for an hour's lively discussion. This show will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 1800 London time. But for now, from this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.